Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think
we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media
would bias.
It's Wednesday, November 30th, 2011, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, Futures Lab Director at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here at the news desk are regular panelists and Missouri School of Journalism faculty colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Well, we're back after a break for Thanksgiving, and our stories this week leave little, perhaps, to be thankful for. ESPN and the local paper in Syracuse, New York, are coming under fire from some quarters. At issue, why they didn't report allegations of sexual abuse by a Syracuse University assistant basketball coach when they first heard about them more than 8 years ago. The New York Times essentially outed the first alleged victim of former Penn State coach Jerry Sandusky last week by telling us everything but the boy's name. The woman who says she had a 13-year affair with presidential candidate Herman Cain says she told her story to an Atlanta TV station because of what she calls leaks to the media. We'll consider whether newspaper endorsements and all those televised debates have significantly affected the fortunes of the Republicans running for president, and we'll ask why one of the country's most prestigious journalism schools is telling its students they can't tweet about classroom discussions unless they get advance permission from faculty, guest speakers, and classmates. Well, let's begin with the latest sex abuse scandal involving an assistant coach for a major university team. In this instance, Bernie Fine, longtime assistant to Syracuse University basketball coach Jim Boeheim, is now accused of molesting at least three former ball boys. Fine had been suspended with pay until ESPN played a taped conversation between Fine's wife and his first alleged victim, Bobby Davis. On Sunday, Syracuse fired Fine. Here's one of the more damning portions of the Lori Fine tape.
I don't want to see that went on. You know, I know everything that went on with him. Bernie has issues. Maybe that he's not aware of, but he has issues. And you trusted somebody you shouldn't have trusted.
Yeah.
Bernie is also in denial. I think that he did the things he did, but he somehow, through his own mental telepathy, has erased them out of his mind.
Well, Charles, obviously this follows on the heels of the Penn State sexual abuse scandal, but there are some differences both in the nature of what allegedly occurred and how the media has been covering it, I think.
Yeah, of controversy swirling and continue to swirl around this story. And I was reading the columns that you posted on our blog before the show and then went out into the broader blogosphere looking around, and it's really tough to figure out whether to be completely condemnatory toward ESPN and the paper there or not. I mean, the Daily Beast column that we posted on the blog is unbelievably condemnatory. I mean, it's saying, you know, let's go fire all the people. It's equating the people at ESPN with the people in the Penn State athletic department, which is, to me, a bit of a overwrought stretch. Yeah. Howard Kurtz takes a much more refined approach and says, you know, it's a tougher issue than that. And I think it is, too. I think corroboration here was a real bear. And they didn't have it. They had a tape. It didn't identify her in any way. I know later somebody went to a voice extra. I don't even know if that would make me. If I were sitting in the editor's shoes and I had some voice recognition expert tell me that that's her, it still wouldn't make me feel really good.
Well, let's parse some of the different things you brought up, Charles. I mean, Lee, first of all, for those of our listeners and viewers who aren't familiar with all the details, essentially the person who made the accusations came to the newspaper back in 2002, 2003 in Syracuse, claiming that he'd been abused by this basketball coach and claiming that there were other people who had been as well. The newspaper investigated it over several months And concluded ultimately that there wasn't enough corroboration. There was no police investigation. They were holding off on doing the story. So the accuser took his story to ESPN. And in addition to making the allegations, he gave this tape that Charles made reference to and that we played a little bit from, surreptitiously recorded with the wife of the coach. And she said some things, although it appears she didn't witness anything, or at least she didn't admit witnessing anything. ESPN has a tape. They don't go to the police. They decide not to air the story because, again, no corroboration from other accusers. So I guess the first question is, should either the paper or ESPN have come forward with the story or at least pursued it more aggressively in their behind-the-scenes reporting, knowing what they did back then?
I think the answer to that, Mike, that question is really pretty straightforward, and the answer is yes. So let me back into how I get to yes. About a decade before all this happened, the Seattle paper did a much similar story on Brock Adams, a man who was known to have problems, and a story that they had had pieces of for almost a decade. That story ultimately cost Adams his Senate seat, but appropriate to this are the kinds of things that they did as journalists to get the eight women who ultimately went on the record to go on the record about Brock Adams and how they treated them. My bottom line is, I don't know when as a profession we're going to get a learning curve. It's not like this is the first time we've encountered this. There were alternatives. ESPN didn't take them. The newspaper didn't take them. So, for example, one of the things that the Seattle paper did was it asked the women to sign an affidavit that should they be sued for libel in court, that they would come forward. You know what? The same thing would have worked here. And it would have allowed them to go forward with a story, which might have also kicked other things loose.
I guess I can see the other side of this. I don't necessarily disagree with you, Lee, but I can see the other side of it, Charles, as saying basically these allegations, if we run them, and with as little verification of them as there was allegedly at the time, we're ruining somebody's career, and that's something we ought to think about. They say, both the paper and ESPN, that essentially no corroboration, no police investigation. You know, how is it for us to expose these allegations?
Well, the Post Standard, of course, in 2002, spent 6 months and a bunch of money, according to their column, on the story and couldn't find that essential second victim. Or if not victim, at least second witness, second corroborator who could say, yes, Mr. Davis's allegations, I know them. He told me this back in 2002. They spent countless hours. And apparently you got to read between the lines on the Syracuse column. But I think between the lines, what they're saying is we had people who would tell us, but they wouldn't come public telling us. And that's a tough, tough, tough issue there.
Charles, you're right. It's a tough issue, but there are ways around it. I mean, there's public with my name and my image attached. There's public the way the Seattle paper did it with Brock Adams. Both of those were equally effective. I don't know whether the journalists here are the equivalent of the Penn State Athletic Department, but I sure think somebody ought to get suspended without pay. And because, I mean, again, these are not stealing money. These are issues of child molestation. This is really a criminal problem here. And normally we're not the cops, but that doesn't mean that you don't come forward.
Yeah, I guess I wonder, at least in ESPN's case, I don't think we heard that the newspaper had the tape. ESPN had the tape in 2003. They didn't take the tape to the police. Should they have? And two, would Lori Fine saying on tape that, yeah, I know my husband did these things, is that the second corroborating source?
It's not for me because I've seen tapes played with too often. Tapes can be spliced, edited, cut. And if I don't have an original, if somebody's just handed me a copy, that tape itself, if you listen to it, it doesn't sound really well, the content of it is horrific, don't get me wrong. But, I mean, the recording of it, the recording itself has some weirdness going on behind it. I don't know what it is. I'm no audio expert, but it's weird. And so if I'm just putting myself in the editor's desk and I'm listening to that, no way am I hinging my career, which is what you're doing, hinging your career. Because if that turns out to be edited, doctored in some way and you ran that story, you're done.
Okay, Charles, I think that's one part of it. But the editor had more than that option. The editor certainly could have taken it to the police, which is not something I normally recommend. But in something like this, you need somebody who's got more power than you do. Subpoena power. Okay, the power to search and, if necessary, seize. You've got a different kind of questioning that can happen. So, no, I'm not necessarily saying that based only on that tape that the editor runs something, but I think that tape is at the end of a whole raft of evidence. And, well, I mean, okay, so the paper spent 6 months. I'm sorry, in the Brock Adams case, the paper literally spent years. I just don't think there was enough thoughtful, depth journalism done here.
Apparently, they told him to go to the police, right?
Right.
Which, yeah, I think was the right call. He did go to the police. They did even less than the newspaper ESPN did.
Which is yet again another story.
Yeah. I mean, because they literally sat on it.
Of course, you know, Bernie Fine, again, is innocent until proven guilty. There is some real serious question about the veracity of the people making the allegations against him this time that isn't true with regard to the multiple victims that, you know, accuse Sandusky of crimes. But I suspect this story about Bernie Fine would never have seen the light of day had it not been for the Penn State case. Well, let's move on to that particular case in a very troubling, I think, Lee, tell me if you agree with this, troubling story in the New York Times last week, which was a profile, quote unquote, of victim number one in the Penn State case, a young boy who was allegedly raped multiple times by Jerry Sandusky. This story in the Times provided every detail necessary to identify this young man, except his name. But you literally could have gone on Google, as the local paper at Penn State pointed out, you could have gone on Google with the New York Times details and found that kid's name easily. They outed him, basically. Was there any justifiable reason for the Times to do that?
No. This is what happens when you're the New York Times and you think that you have to play catch-up journalism, because this is a story that's essentially in your backyard and you didn't have it. I read the part of the story that we posted on our blog. Basically, what this is a writer trying to demonstrate what a wonderful writer they are by collecting all sorts of details and not spending a single solitary second, as I can figure out, looking at the details and going, huh, what does this add up to?
Do you see any justification for the Times story as it was written, Charles?
Well, I mean, not in those details. The overall story, if they would have taken out all of the identifying details, would have been the same story. That's why it's such a tragedy. That story could have been every bit as effective without tie-dye socks and the name of the subdivision, right? I mean, it would have still been a really compelling story. To include that was to identify the victim, clearly.
Right.
And I just don't know. I mean, I blame the writer. I really blame the editors, because I mean, an editor's job often is to walk a writer down from a perch that they have placed themselves through their writing and say, do you see what's going on here? And then the writer will often go, oh, yeah, I see your point. This was a total collapse, I think.
And Lee, the Patriot News, the local paper there, which has done a really excellent job of covering the Penn State scandal, pointed out why they don't name the names of sexual assault victims, and also pointed out, and I wonder if you agree with this argument, that what the New York Times did, whether they meant to or not, was basically lessen the chance that any other kids in cases like this are ever going to come forward.
It's hard for me to know in any particular instance if that's the case, but certainly overall, what the New York Times did is going to make it much, much tougher for people to come forward and think that, well, my local community has protected me. You know, the big boys from down the street are just going to out me in a heartbeat, which is pretty much what happened.
Well, and I wonder about just one point, and I'm not defending the Times, but I found it interesting in reading their story. They pointed out that already before they printed their story, that other people, other students in this boy's school, had been taunting him because they knew who he was, not through the Times story, obviously. They knew who he was, and they basically drove him out of school. He decided to quit. So I guess the question is, does that in any way give the Times an excuse when the boy, at least locally, had already been, quote, outed?
No. I mean, if anything, it compounds the error. I mean, people are always going to find out about stuff through the grapevine, through non-media ways in a community, right? I mean, I don't know of any assault situation, like when there's one on campus, tragically, which has happened through the years, people in the dorm know who the victim was. And typically, instead of it's so saddening to hear that he was taunted. Usually what happens is people rush to protect that victim. And then if the news media runs something identifying, what you've done is amplify that a hundredfold to, you know, the residents of the world instead of the community.
I think what it essentially says to me is that the New York Times, for whatever reason, in this particular instance, but I can think of several others, really doesn't have a clue about what the concept of privacy means. And within that, doesn't really have a very good clue about what the concept of community means when it's not New York, New York. Shame on them.
Let's move on to our second topic today. It looks like the GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain, it looked like, I should have said, might survive those multiple allegations of sexual harassment. But then came the interview given Monday night to the Fox TV affiliate in Atlanta by a Georgia woman who said she'd had a 13-year affair with Cain.
I wanted to come out and give my side before it was thrown out there and made out to be something, you know, filthy. Which some people will look at it, at this and say, well, that's exactly what it is.
Senior I-Team reporter Dale Russell is here now with his exclusive interview with Ginger White. Dale?
Russ, our investigation began with a tip from a person who knew Atlanta businesswoman Ginger White. An alleged Miss White had an affair with Herman Cain. The tipster also alerted other national media, who all reached out to Miss White. Well, Ginger White told me she had an off-and-on affair for more than 13 years with Herman Cain. And she felt she had no choice but to come forward and tell her story on her terms.
Cain has since told his staff that he's considering whether to drop out of the Republican presidential competition. Well, first, I guess, let's just say that she came out with her claim because she felt compelled to, that she was being approached by various media outlets that had heard rumors that she'd had an affair. And so she thought she needed to tell the story her way. Any reason that media shouldn't have been pursuing this story when they got rumors of him having a 13-year affair?
No. I mean, I can't imagine any, because that's – you're running for president of the United States of America, and you are repeatedly claiming that you have no skeletons. And every time another affair comes up, he denies it, you know, vigorously. I thought it's very interesting. The response to this one has been very different. Mm-hmm. I also – poor Herman. I mean – Every person who comes out could not be more eloquent, more measured. I mean, sometimes you see people come up and you watch the allegations. You're like, well, how much veracity do you give that? I thought this was a staggering blow. I mean, I thought she was incredibly eloquent. Her reasoning seemed perfectly legitimate to me, which was, I have 27 different television stations camped outside my front door. Might as well get in front of this thing.
Well, and the other argument she made, and I felt she made it fairly eloquently too, was in saying that she'd heard all of these other women make their accusations and heard claim calling them categorical liars on David Letterman and many other programs, and she just felt like it was unfair for them to be labeled automatically that way. That seemed like a pretty good reason for her to tell her story, I guess.
It's a pretty good reason for her. It's a much more compelling reason to say, you know, just telling the truth actually will probably get you a lot further than what Herman Cain has done. I think it goes back to the point that Charles was making earlier about the other story, which is these are not secrets that can be kept. People know, you know, whether it's the folks in the dorm or her friends and associates over, you know, over 13 years. And I'm just continually amazed at, it doesn't matter who it is, you know, it could be, you know, Gary Hart or Bill Clinton or Brock Adams or whoever it is, the hubris of these folks who think that, this is never going to happen to me. I just don't know what planet they're on.
But you said, Charles, that there's been a different reaction to this particular set of allegations. And I think one of the ways in which it's different is that even though reporters have, I mean, doing their job, dug up some information about Ginger White and her legal problems and her business problems and all of that, it's like nobody cares. And especially money people and conservative leaders in the Republican Party don't care. This is one of those, I guess, one of those situations you don't escape from if you're a candidate. Maybe you escape from it once you're in office. But as a candidate for president, you don't.
Unless you're Newt Gingrich, apparently. I mean, he seems to have weathered the adultery thing much better than Herman. Maybe because Newt never lied about it. The problem with Mr. Kane is he tends to accuse the accusers of being category liars, which then creates another that pops up and says, well, if you're going to call us all liars, then I might as well come public as well. And this was the body blow fatal to me. I mean, I can't imagine his campaign surviving this.
So what do you make, Lee, and Charles weigh in on this too, of his lawyers, Kane's lawyers' argument in this one, which is somewhat different but also somewhat classic, which is basically he didn't deny the claim as Kane did, but the lawyer said these are accusations about consensual sexual behavior between adults, and it's none of the media's and none of the public's business.
So I'm going to quote Aaron Sorkin from the American president, who has at one point saying, the American people will decide what is and is not their business. And I think that's well said.
I like it. It's a very enlightened sort of French view of adultery, however. It's unusual in America. The other thing you should note is that his attorney, a man named Lynn Wood, was also Richard Jewell's attorney. He makes a living by suing media defendants for libel. That's effectively what this guy does for a living.
Speaking of the GOP field, there's been some really interesting speculation in the press over the past couple of weeks about the impact of certain behaviors of the media and whether they influence how popular or how well the Republican candidates are doing. The first involves endorsements. As we probably all know from this past week, the Manchester Union Leader, the arch-conservative newspaper in New Hampshire, wrote an editorial, a front-page editorial, endorsing Newt Gingrich. And Newt Gingrich appears to have benefited, at least in the short run, somewhat incredibly from this. He's come from the back of the pack to performance in the debates, where he's taken on the media as much as anybody else, to all of a sudden he's right up there with Mitt Romney in New Hampshire. So I guess the first question I'd ask of you, Charles, you know, it seems like the conventional wisdom has been over time that endorsements really don't make that much difference. Who pays attention to them? Lots of times the people who are endorsed lose. And yet there's some statistical support, as we show on our blog this week from a piece in the New York Times, that there actually is a bump that these candidates over the past, I think, six different New Hampshire primaries, presidential candidates have benefited from this endorsement by 11%.
Hmm. Well, the New Hampshire primary is a peculiar hot box in which, A, you have a single newspaper that dominates the agenda. A lot of other media markets are much more crowded and diffuse, and so I think endorsements don't have the resonance that the news that is a significant. The Union Leader's endorsement is a very significant endorsement. The other thing, of course, front page in a season in which I don't know if we've ever in the history of the Republic had a primary season on either ticket that looks like this one. And so, I mean, there are a lot of strange variables there, but I know our former colleague Wayne Wanta did a couple of studies on endorsements, and if I remember them correctly, he found a slight bump, but nothing super significant either.
Well, and to add on to that, in Wanta's study and in a number of others that have been done by political scientists, slight bump does not translate into win.
Right,
and it
right,
does,
right.
And it absolutely does not translate into winning the presidency, which is, I think, something it's a contextual thing, you know, like everything
right.
else. I also got a big charge out of the editor of the Union Leader because he was asked about this, I think it was on All Things Considered, saying, well, is this going to affect your news coverage? And his response was, well, it's a front page editorial and we will continue to write front page editorials, but it's not going to do anything to our news coverage, which was, to quote Charles, a little bit of a head scratcher for me, since usually the front page is where you put your news.
Another instance of alleged media impact has been with regard to the debates. Now, we will have had before the Iowa caucuses 13 televised GOP presidential candidate debates. And there are some folks who are speculating that this time around, at least, they really may have been made a difference. For example, one observation in one column is that all the candidates now are playing it much more safe than in the past because they're trying desperately to avoid the so-called YouTube moment. Do you find some logic in that
argument? I think that's true. I mean, you can almost see a you can almost see a funneling down in terms of the rhetoric since that Rick Perry, I forget the third one moment that has gotten millions of hits on YouTube. People are trying to avoid just that moment happening to them. The more words per answer, the more the likelihood of a meltdown. And so what you're seeing, I watched a little bit of the last debate, and what you see are much, much tighter responses to the questions.
But I'm not sure that that is all about YouTube, because I've seen a couple of studies about as debates proceed, how much shorter and shorter and shorter the answers get. And this is not a 2011-2012 campaign
That's
phenomenon. People have been honing, crafting, editing their answers in a way that makes them shorter, blander, and then agreeing to rules of the game that will not allow follow-up questions.
There's also this perceived effect that the debates this time around at least have allowed the so-called, quote, second-tier candidates to rise up, whether it's Michelle Bachmann or Herman Cain or even Newt Gingrich, when you had all of the pundits and the political party leaders, you know, downplaying their chances. The debates have given them an opportunity.
I think it's the debates have had a great deal. The debates and the affairs are probably the two most fluid things in terms of people moving up and down. That and some of the extreme positions that some of those candidates take, which even in their own – even in that party dynamic right now begins to sort of peel people off.
Back to are the media having an impact? And my response is say it and claim it. Yes, we are. And furthermore, this is what we're supposed to do. It's not like we're putting words in anybody's mouth. We are giving people – many opportunities to share who they are and what they think with the American public. And if there are gaffes and if there are misstatements of facts and if there are brain freezes, that's all part of that process, and it should be on public display.
Yeah, I think there's something salutary about the fact that these debates have kind of democratized the process. You don't have to have the most money. You don't have to have the biggest ground game in the early states to be able to do well. Now, what you do with that opportunity is up to you, and some of them have not really done a good job with it. But at least the media have given them that chance. I want to focus on one last topic. We just have a couple of minutes left, but this one is sort of near and dear to our hearts. You'll recall, our listeners will, the debate on this campus about whether or not students should be prohibited from taping what is said in their classes. There's been a lot of debate here about whether that's right or wrong. The J schools kind of weighed in all on one side. There are other sides to the issue. But now the Columbia University School of Journalism is issuing its own guidelines, basically saying students may not tweet or post on Facebook anything that is said in their classes or by guest speakers unless they have advanced approval. The idea being, as much was made in the University of Missouri case, the classroom needs to be a safe space for debate. Charles?
Welcome to the Myanmar School of Communication. I just can't imagine this sort of authoritarian regime in a school that purportedly teaches journalists how to do journalism. I mean, we should be about the open, freewheeling exchange of ideas, and that includes us as the role models, purportedly, for these little budding tweeters. I mean, these are people that are going to tweet in their daily job 1,000 times a day, and we're telling them, when you walk in this sacred room, you are now to put away all the tools of your trade until you leave.
And in 30 seconds or less, do you have the same sort of ironic feeling about this one, Lee?
Actually, not quite, because the students taught me this something this morning. I talked about this with a freshman fig class, and I said, well, okay, what rules would you come up with? And the rule they came up with was, well, you can't do it to cheat. And dumb me, I said, okay, so how do you do this? He said, well, it's really simple. You take your phone, you take a picture of the test, and you post it. I thought, okie dokie then. Clearly, I have not thought this through at the level that you have.
I would just like to think, and I'm not justifying what the school did, but this sounds an awful lot like something that might have been imposed by higher-ups in the university administration.
Yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. And thanks to Lee and Charles for their analysis and opinions. Thanks to our technical crew, Director Travis McMillan with RJI, audio engineer Pat Akers with KBIA, and student producer Ryan Williams. Thank you also for listening and watching. You can visit our new blog by going to kbia.org and clicking on the Talk Shows menu. You can also read related stories, watch video, listen to audio there, and you can also send us email at views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Lee will be at the helm next week for another edition of KBIA's Views of the